Hello? This is Immigration Solutions. We're just waiting for our callers to log on at the moment. Hi, if you're logging in, we're just waiting for a few people to log on to the call. We'll get started in just a moment. Tom, are you on the call? Hi, this is Immigration Solutions. We're just waiting for a few people to log in. Tom, are you on the call yet?
Yes, I just arrived.
Okay, good. We'll wait another minute and then we'll get started. Well, hello and welcome to the Immigration Solutions teleconference series today. Our topic is the paper trail to an L1A visa. We have the callers in muted today so that everyone will have a clear connection. At the end of the call, when we open up to Q&A, you can unmute your phone by pressing star 6. For those of you on the call who are employers and L1A employees, I'm sure that you understand that the L1A program has really become completely paper-ridden, with cases that measure almost 5 inches thick being sent to the service centers for adjudication. So when you're frequently asked to yet submit more information, those infamous RFEs, requests for evidence, that are very popular with the L1 visa program, you sort of start to wonder, is anyone looking at this information? And if they are, do they understand how to interpret the documentation sent? Some of it is very complex, particularly the corporate documentation for the employer abroad. Do the adjudicators understand how to interpret the documentation for qualifying relationships, ownership, etc.? So you're probably wondering, as we are frequently, what has happened to the L1A program? It seems like it's deteriorating. And this is something that we're going to discuss today. We're going to just, you know, basically do an overview of the L1A manager executive classification under the intracompany transferee L-Visa program. And we do a lot of L1 immigration casework here at Immigration Solutions. We're going to have our supervising attorney, Tom Joy, to participate with me on this call. And so we're going to get started now. We'll go probably a good 35 to 40 minutes. And depending upon how many of you are on the line and have questions, we'll certainly open up to handle your questions. So, Tom, let's kind of break this down for our callers today, and why don't we start general and go specific? And I guess a good question to open up with is, what is an L1A intracompany transferee visa?
Well, as the name implies, intracompany transferee means that there's a family of related companies in the world, and that an executive or a manager or a specialized knowledge person who is employed by one of the companies in the related family, a qualifying organization we call it, is being transferred to the United States to be an executive, a manager, or a specialized knowledge person in the United States for the related company in the United States. If the person is coming to the U.S. as an executive or a manager, That's L1A classification. And if the person is coming to the United States in a specialized knowledge capacity, then that person is in L1B classification. We will be looking exclusively today at the L1A classification for executives and managers. A teleconference will be held at a later date regarding the separate and very complex issue of, and getting more complex, the L1B classification. Now, typical reasons why personnel are transferred to the U.S. Can include, among other things, the foreign entity is looking to break into the U.S. market and establishing a new office in the U.S., and they want to transfer an executive or a manager to start it up. Or alternatively, there's been a merger or an acquisition involving the foreign company, and they have now maybe gained a U.S. Related company as part of the acquisition or merger, and they want to transfer some of their established managerial and executive personnel in the foreign company over to the U.S. to get the people in the U.S. In order based on company policies and procedures and that sort of thing. And then other transfers involve transfers of technology. R&D, research and development, is oftentimes done in the U.S., and manufacturing is done outside the U.S. Marketing is done all over the world. So transfers can be for many different reasons. Initially, it's possible to ask for up to 3 years initially on an L1. But if it's a new office in the U.S., in other words, the office has been in existence for less than 1 year, the most you can get to start with is 1 year. And we'll talk separately about new offices a little bit later.
All
and
right.
Then finally, extensions. Extensions are granted in increments of up to 2 years at a time. L1A managers get a 7-year maximum total, and then they have to leave the United States before they can come back and start another run in L1A status. And it's most important to understand that only time physically spent in the U.S. in L1A status counts towards the 7-year maximum limit. Okay?
Good. All right. Now let's go on to our next question, Tom, which is, what exactly is an L1A manager? How is that defined according to immigration regulations?
Well, an L1A manager is defined in the regulations as a person who primarily, and primarily is a key word in the definition, who primarily manages a part of the company, supervises and controls the work of other supervisory, professional, or managerial employees, and has authority to hire and fire or recommend those, as well as other personnel actions, and exercises discretion over the day-to-day operations. Now, the regulations distinguish between what we call people managers and functional managers, managers that manage people, and managers that manage functions. Most commonly, we run into managers who manage people. And it's important to understand in the regulations that a first-line manager with only one level of personnel under him or her, a first-line manager is not a manager unless the people managed are a degree professionals, basically. So you, in order to be a manager, you either have to have a second level of management, assistant management, for example, beneath you on the org chart, or if you're a first-line manager, the people managed have to be degree professionals. More complex is the functional manager, more controversial, and basically it's in the regulations, but it's very, very difficult to prove, and it's probably fading out of existence. Here and there you might get one, but it's not something to be relied on. But basically, a functional manager manages an essential function of the company at a senior level, does not manage people. So that's the definition of manager.
Now let's discuss the definition of an executive.
Okay. The other part of L1A is for executives. Remember, L1A covers both executives and managers.
Mm-hmm.
An L1 executive is a person who primarily, and remember, there's that word again, primarily. Primarily means more than 50% of the time. You know, some managers in small companies and executives in small companies do some of the day-to-day operations, but they must be primarily managing or primarily being an executive more than 50% of the time, and as much more than 50% as possible. Otherwise, you're inviting a very detailed request for evidence. But an executive primarily directs the management. In other words, tells the managers what to do, establishes goals and policies for the company, exercises wide latitude in discretionary decision-making, and receives only general supervision or direction from upper-level executives or from the board of directors. So that's the definition of executive.
All right. Now, it was interesting that you brought in the element of functional manager to the L1A manager category. Sometimes it's a little difficult to discern the difference between a functional manager and an executive. Can you speak to that a little bit? What might be some of the things that you take into consideration to make that differentiation?
All right. An executive, as I indicated, is a person who sets goals and policies for the company. Executives are generally found at or near the very top of the org chart for the company, sets goals and policies, and directs the management. In other words, directs the managers beneath him on the org chart.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely, if ever, does an executive do any of the day-to-day operations, even in small companies, but it does happen, if it does happen at all, in a small company. Whereas functional managers, they manage an essential function, and they are generally found on the org chart in the middle or upper middle of the org chart. They manage an essential function, basically a department, not really a department, but a function of the company that does not have people in it other than him or herself. But they manage that function at a senior level. They make the day-to-day decisions, the discretionary decisions, and with very little supervision or direction from above. And generally, they don't do day-to-day operations, although they may do some because they don't have people to delegate to. So there may be some day-to-day operations that they do, but they primarily manage that function.
Right. Now, moving into the qualifying relationship issue between the foreign employer and the U.S. employer, what requirements need to be satisfied for that qualifying relationship?
All right. The basic underlying concept for an L1 is there must be a certain level of common ownership and control between the company abroad that the person is coming from and the company in the U.S. that they are coming to. And the general relationships mentioned in the regulations are parent-subsidiary or subsidiary-parent. It can go either way. Affiliates, where the same parent or individual owns and controls both of the companies, the company abroad and the company the person is transferring to. In other words, the companies are brother-sister with a common parent. Or a branch where the company abroad and the company in the U.S. are the same entity, the same corporation, for example, but the U.S. Office is simply an office of the same corporation, but in a different location. In other words, not a separate legal entity. Now, what is control? or what level of ownership and control is necessary. Well, certainly more than 50% ownership is adequate ownership and control. 50-50, where the person has 50% ownership, that is considered control. It is what we call deadlock control, meaning with 50%, while you may not be able to accomplish all you want, you can certainly block the other 50% from doing what they may want to do if it's different. So 50% is enough ownership for control. And in certain unusual situations, even less than 50% can work as control. An example that I normally give is, say, a person or a parent company owns 40% of a company, of a subsidiary, and the other 60% is widely dispersed among many different owners, with no one owner owning more than maybe 5%. That 40%, even though it's less than 50, can, in a situation like that, control the company. Other requirements for the petitioner company in the U.S. and the company abroad that the person is coming from. Remember, it's an intra-company transferee, and it must be multinational at all times, meaning the family of companies must be doing business in the United States and at least one other country in the world at all times that the person is in the U.S. on the L-1. So doing business is defined as the regular providing of goods and services, goods and or services, and not merely the presence of an office or an agent. So typically the way it works would be the company abroad that the person is transferring from would continue in existence abroad, continue doing business in the foreign country, and then the person is coming to the U.S. to work in the U.S. company that's obviously doing business in the U.S. However, let's say you have a transfer where, as a result of the transfer or shortly after the transfer, the foreign company winds down and goes out of business. Do we still have an L-1? Yes, we can if the group of companies has another company somewhere in the world that continues to do, other than the U.S., that continues to do business, another subsidiary or another affiliate, for example. So the company the person came from does not necessarily have to be the company that continues doing business outside the U.S. during the pendency of the L-1.
Does there have to be a U.S. entity available to obviously assume this employee for them to remain in the U.S.?
It does not necessarily need to be a U.S. entity, but it needs to be in existence and doing business in the United States to employ the person physically in the United States, yes.
Okay. All right. Shall we move on?
Yes, please.
Okay. What is the employee required to produce to be eligible for an L-1A visa?
All right. Two things, basically. The regulations state that the employee must prove that they have been employed in a capacity involving either executive, managerial, or specialized knowledge duties for the related company outside the United States for at least 1 year, full-time, continuous 1 year, out of the 3 years immediately prior to filing the L-1 petition. Mm-hmm. They must have been, we're bringing them over as an L-1A executive or manager. However, they can qualify if they were either an executive or a manager or a specialized knowledge person outside the United States for the related company for at least one continuous full-time year of the three previous years prior to filing the L-1 case.
Tom, does the individual abroad have to be in the managerial capacity there in order to qualify as a manager in the U.S.?
That's a good question. The regulations do state that it is not necessary, I repeat, not necessary for the person to be coming to the United States to do the same thing that they were doing abroad. For example, a specialized knowledge person abroad for 1 year can be transferred to the U.S., promoted into a managerial position in the U.S. A manager can, who is a manager abroad for a year, could be coming to the U.S. as an executive, or any different combination of those things.
It seems as though immigration is putting a lot of emphasis on wanting to see that if they are coming to assume a position in the U.S. as a manager, that they have previously held a managerial position abroad. This issue seems to be coming up a lot in the RFEs. Why do you think it is?
I'll discuss why I think a lot of things are coming up in RFEs a little bit later, towards the end of our discussion. But I have my own opinions, but based on my experience. But the other thing I wanted to mention was, remember, a person can qualify abroad as 1 year executive or 1 year manager or 1 year specialized knowledge. But to be an L1, they must be coming to the United States to be an executive or a manager. Specialized knowledge in the U.S. will be an L1B. We'll discuss at a later time. The second thing the person needs to prove is that they have the education, training, and experience that qualifies them to be an executive or a manager in the United States. And typically, the 1 year or more of qualifying experience with the related company abroad is more than adequate to show that. All right?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that we've talked about what the employee has to evidence, let's talk about what the employers have to produce in terms of documentation for an L1A case.
All right. I divide this part of the discussion into two parts. One is for large companies, large, very established companies, generally publicly held companies, mm-hmm. and very, very large privately held companies. Okay. And then the other group is, well, basically everybody else, medium to small companies and startups. Now, for large companies, generally, the corporate document, we have to prove the corporate relationship between the U.S. company and the company abroad that the person is coming from, and we have to prove that the group of companies is doing business in the United States and at least one other country in the world at all times. So what documents typically do we use in large or publicly held companies? Well, generally, if it's publicly held, they have an annual report. And they have audited financial statements. And subsidiaries and affiliates and branches are generally listed in the annual reports and the audited financials. And another useful document for publicly held companies is the SEC 10-K form. It's the Securities and Exchange form, a U.S. government agency that regulates stock trading in the United States. That form also has all the subsidiaries and affiliates listed. Audited financial statements from the company's auditor generally will list that too, so that can be helpful. In terms of doing business, tax returns or audited financial statements are quite adequate for large established companies. For smaller companies, generally, we submit copies of the actual stock certificates showing the ownership and control between the two companies, the company abroad and the company in the U.S., as well as related documents like the stock ledger that show, you know, who else owns stock in the company and maybe minutes of the board meeting authorizing the issuance of the stock. And again, tax returns for small companies are generally required or submitted, as well as maybe invoices and financial statements to show that they're doing business in the U.S. and one other country at the same time. And then finally, although it's not a controlling document, it may be helpful in complex ownership cases where there's, for example, several layers of holding companies and different percentages of ownership between different levels of subsidiaries, and it can be very, very complex and mind-boggling to go through this stuff. I always personally have to draw a picture just to understand some of these things, but
sure.
It may help to get a letter from either general counsel of the company or the CEO or maybe generally the CFO in complex ownership cases, just explaining in more or less plain English or as close as you can get to it what the ownership is and control is between the related entities. So that you know, they don't, the government doesn't have to plow through pages and pages and pages of impossible to read legal documents. So
assists them in interpreting the evidence that's being submitted. If you have a letter that kind of puts it into plain language.
Right, right. That's
mm-hmm.
my point.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I think this is a good time to discuss also the particular requirements for a new office being opened in the United States for, you know, to which an L-1A employee is being transferred.
All right. Let's say a foreign company wants to break into the American market, for example. That's a very common purpose of establishing a new office in the United States. Well, they don't have any presence in the U.S. at the moment, so they want to send one of their executives or managers over to the U.S. to start up a new office. What do we need to prove? What do we need to submit? Well, basically, we need to show all of the things that I've talked about previously, but in addition, we need to show that office premises have been arranged or obtained in the United States. In other words, a lease of office space in the U.S. adequate to house the number of people and what you want to do in the United States. I will tell you this, the government does not like virtual offices.
I know.
And home offices, okay? And I saw a case, I can't remember what state it was in, I want to say North Carolina or South Carolina, I may be wrong, but the particular county in that particular state had a regulation that allowed people who wanted to establish home offices to go into the county office and register their house, their home, as an office. And get licensed, and even with all that bureaucratic red tape and documentation to back us up, the government didn't like the home office concept. And the reason is, and especially with virtual offices, it is too susceptible to fraud in many cases. So they want to see the premises are arranged. At a minimum, they're going to ask for the lease agreement. And they often ask for a floor plan with the square footage to make sure that the space that you do have is adequate to meet your needs for what you want to do and the number of people. You also need a business plan with projections into the future, 3 to 5 years generally. Your standard pro forma business plan, you know, about revenue and expenses and personnel and marketing and the general things in a business plan. And then, most important, you must be able to, with this evidence, show that after 1 year, this new office will be grown to a point where it will support the ongoing need, justify the ongoing need for an executive or a manager to be in the United States after the first year. If you can do that, then the L1A executive or manager can get the first two-year extension. If you cannot do that, then the executive or manager will be going home. So what do they look at for the extensions after that first year of the new office? Well, in the old days, they seemed to only focus on revenue. But now the focus seems to have shifted from not just revenue to personnel. Remember I said an executive or a manager does not do the day-to-day operations of the company. You need to have people filled in on that org chart for the U.S. company so that the executive or the manager can delegate the day-to-day operations, like who drives the truck or who makes the product, those sorts of things. You need to have people to delegate the day-to-day operations to so that the executive or the manager are primarily, more than 50% of their time, doing executive duties, as we defined, or managerial duties, as we defined. That seems to be what they focus on mostly after that first year, make sure there are people to do the day-to-day operations. Otherwise, you'll get a standard denial that says, you don't seem to have anybody able to delegate your day-to-day operations to, therefore you must be doing them, therefore you're not an executive or a manager, and the case is denied.
Yes, there's a lot of focus on that these days. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's right. A new office.
Let's talk about some tips and suggestions for organizing documentation in a way that these adjudicating officers can get it.
All right.
Now, in the past, we have done very detailed exhibit schedules and kind of lessened the length of the oratory of the letter because basically they're spending 15 or 20 minutes. They can't figure it out. They're sending out RFEs, and oftentimes they're asking for things in the RFEs that have already been submitted. So they either didn't see them in there, they were not clearly described in a way that was understandable. Can you speak to this, Tom, with some tips and suggestions?
Sure. It's important to understand why we're getting more and more, and almost routinely, RFEs or requests for evidence on L1 cases now, and why there's this added scrutiny. There are two reasons, in my opinion. Number one is the economy. The economy is poor in the United States, and there seems to be an unwritten memorandum somewhere that tells the government to make it harder for foreign workers to come in because we got all these unemployed, allegedly qualified U.S. workers that need work. Now, I have yet to see that memo. I don't think it exists, but that seems to be the general feeling. In times of economic distress, the scrutiny by the immigration gets tougher. In good times, they don't care as much, and things are a lot looser. It fluctuates with the economy. That's probably the main driving force. But in there also is the concern for fraud. L1 visas are generally recognized as a visa that there's a lot of fraud involved. Two countries right now that are at the top of the list for fraud, and everything is presumed to be fraudulent. Anything coming from PR China, and anything coming from Russia. Those are the two that the government stereotype, and an L1A from China, an L1 from China can take forever because oftentimes they send people out to the office in China to see if it really is an office or a building or if it's a vacant lot or if it's a gas station. So that there's a lot of fraud. Now, and the government, you have to understand, there's certain things required in the regulations, but there's a catch-all phrase too. And that the immigration can ask for any other additional document that they feel is necessary to adjudicate the case. And that's where all these things are coming from on these RFEs, these requests for evidence that go on for 3, 4, 5, 6 pages. Now, what we have found has been very, very helpful is I've been practicing immigration law for over 30 years, and Leslie's been in the field for 20 years, and we have accumulated a lot of RFEs in our time.
Yes, we have.
They seem to be longer and longer and longer, and just when you think that you have a handle on it and you know what they want and you anticipate everything you've ever seen in an RFE in the past, and you put it in there, so they can't possibly give you another RFE because you've already given them everything preemptively, they come back with an additional thing they want. So it continues to happen, and it will never stop.
And most often we find this comes from the California Service Center these days.
Right, right. How do we deal with RFEs? Well, the best way to deal with RFEs is to prevent them in the first place. Anticipate what they're looking for based on experience. Secondly, as Leslie alluded to, how do you present your initial case? Well, we recently got an RFE that was a beautiful, beautiful blueprint of every issue. I think it was 5 or 7 pages long, Leslie. That was a headache to deal with. But the benefit of it was it covered every single issue that has ever arisen in the history of L1A cases. And it did it in a certain order, and we have used that as a blueprint for how we structure our new cases now. We actually have filed our cases in the order listed on this RFE and have received approvals back without RFEs on those cases. So it seems that they like to see things in a certain order and presented in a certain way, and the best evidence that gave us a clue of how they wanted it and made it easy for them, a roadmap that we could get them from point A to point B, was just to follow that extensive RFE that they had given out in the past.
Because this is a checklist for them.
Exactly, yeah.
And we also are starting to arrange our exhibit schedules in the same way. Everything that we're submitting about the employer abroad is not strung throughout the case as you throw it in. It's in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go and see, check it off. Okay, the same thing for the U.S. employer. The same thing for qualifying relationship issues. Maintenance of status for the beneficiary. Information about the beneficiary. Their employment verification, their credentials, their resume. All neatly, tightly organized. So basically, they can take their cheat sheet, look at your exhibit schedule, and they know if the case has what is required before they even read the letters or look at the forms.
I believe, Tom,
that that's what they do, don't you?
As a practical matter, I have seen the training materials that the adjudicators are given, and it's basically a checklist. And if it's an L1A, they pull out their L1A checklist that they got in the training class, and they go down the list one by one by one. Now, it's a cycle. It's an unending cycle, in my opinion. The more scrutiny they give, the longer the RFEs are. The longer the RFEs are, then the more complex and the more pages we're starting to submit in the initial case. And because we never know what's enough. And then the more we submit, the less likely they're going to sit down and read the whole thing. And then the more likely you are to get another RFE that simply is a boilerplate laundry list RFE that's 7 pages long. So why not just do the case in the first place exactly how the RFE, and you're going to get an RFE in most cases, just do it in the same order that the RFE is and be done with it. And that will increase your odds of not getting an RFE. The other two items that I use as tips on how to avoid RFEs, or at least major issues on RFEs, job descriptions. Be as detailed, technical detail as possible on job descriptions. And most important, because you'll get it on the RFE if you don't do it initially, assign a percentage of time to each job duty. In other words, during the week, what percentage of time does the person work on this duty and on the next duty? And the point is, if you're trying to show the person's primarily an executive or primarily a manager, you have to show substantially more than 50% of his time is either executive time or managerial duties.
And it's very advisable that you also additionally tie that to an organizational chart, an actual picture of that job that is being described,
and where that person
fits in the org chart.
Right. On that point, that was the second item, second tip, organizational chart. You're going to need an organizational chart from the foreign entity to show where the person was in the hierarchy of the foreign company, make sure they were, well, keep in mind, to be an L1A in the U.S., they don't have to be an executive or a manager. They could have been a specialized knowledge person abroad. But that's unusual, but it is possible. Org charts. You've got to show everybody above your person and everybody below your person. And it seems that even if you do that, you're going to get an RFE asking for the job title, the salary, the educational background, and the job duties of everybody above your person and everybody below your person on the org chart anyway, so why not submit it up front? So.
But isn't that absolutely overreaching regulations? We've seen them come back and ask for the Social Security numbers and the immigration status of everyone, you know, in a company. Generally, this is for a small to medium-sized company.
Well,
but is that really permitted?
Yes, it is. Their standard response at liaison meetings to the burdensome RFEs is regulations allow us to ask for anything that is relevant to help us make a decision. And that's why they do it. Specifically, why do they want Social Security numbers? They want to make sure the people you're putting on the org chart are real people and not just made-up people. There's a lot of fraud in the business. And why do they want a past immigration history? Well, let's just say if everybody on your org chart is an L1A manager executive, who's doing the day-to-day operations of the company? So,
and in smaller entities, I guess they would be more highly attuned to ask that question.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I represented many years ago a bank, and it was just the funniest thing. Everybody on that org chart, everybody that we brought over from the foreign company, and everybody on that org chart was a vice president. they all had a title of vice president. Vice president of something, but they didn't have any people underneath them on the org chart. Well, this was before the major scrutiny on these cases, so today that would never fly. That would get a 10-page RFE. So those are some tips on how to avoid RFEs.
Well, before we open the call up to Q&A, let's tackle the last question, which is, how does an L1A executive manager obtain a green card?
Okay. Generally, to get a green card, it's a three-step process. The first step is called labor certification. The company has to prove that they've advertised and recruited and tried to find a qualified American worker and that they cannot find one. And they have to comply with all the Department of Labor regulations in that process, which, if you think this is complex, that is 10 times worse. We try to avoid labor certification at all costs. The second step is a petition by the company to classify into the quota immigrant visa quota category, and then the third step is the person's green card application. If you can show that you are an executive or manager, remember, not specialized knowledge abroad, but an executive or a manager abroad, and you're being transferred to the U.S. to be an executive or a manager, specialized knowledge doesn't count in either of these cases, then you are exempt. You are exempt from that first part of the green card case, the labor certification, and that will cut down the time and the work by at least 50% and the
yep.
cost. So that's how that would lead to a green card. So it's important when you're looking at a case initially to analyze not just the short term, how are we going to get this person into the U.S. and get them to work right away, but the long term too. Do we want to keep them permanently with a green card? So if we do, then maybe the best way is to try and structure the initial entry as an L1A and then make it easier to get the green card later on. All right.
Very good. All right. Well, that pretty much concludes our end. At this point, we are certainly ready to take any questions that you might have. What you'll need to do if you want to ask a question is to unmute your phone. by pressing star 6. And we'll start taking any questions you might have right now. Would anyone like to ask a question? Well, all right. Then I'm hoping all of you have gotten your L1As approved and want to thank you for participating on the call today. If after maybe re-listening to this conference, and we will be uploading it to the website, you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. We're available to assist you with your L1 casework or any other employment-related matter. And if you'd like to certainly become a client of Immigration Solutions, please contact us. Again, I'm going to just pause for a minute. Has a question dawned on anyone that you'd like to ask before we conclude today? All right. Well, thank you so much for participating. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.